in the nursery. The fine clear weather still held. There was sunshine and blue sky again when I drew my curtains. I'd slept lightly and restlessly, troubled by snatches of peculiar, disconnected dreams. Perhaps I had eaten and drunk too well and richly with Mr. Daly, but my mood was unchanged. I was determined and optimistic as I dressed and breakfasted, and then began to make preparations for my stay at Ealmarsh House. The little dog Spider had, somewhat to my surprise, slept motionlessly at the foot of my bed. I had taken to her, though I knew little of the way of dogs. She was spirited, lively and alert, and yet completely biddable. The expression in her bright eyes, fringed a little by shaggy hair that formed itself somewhat comically into the shape of beetling eyebrows, seemed to me highly intelligent. I thought I was going to be very glad of her. Just after 9 o'clock, the landlord summoned me to the telephone. It was Mr. Bentley, crisp and curt, for he greatly disliked using the instrument. He had received my letter and agreed that I should stay until I had at least made some sort of sense of the Drabble papers and managed to sort out what looked as if it needed to be dealt with from all the out-of-date rubbish. I was to parcel up and dispatch anything I thought important, leave the remainder in the house for the attention of the legatees at some future date, and then return to London. "It's an odd sort of place," I said. She was an odd sort of woman. And Mr. Bentley clapped the receiver down hard, blistering my ear. By 9:30, I had the bicycle basket and panniers packed and ready, and I set off, Spider bounding behind me. I couldn't leave it any later, or the tide would have risen across the causeway, and it occurred to me, as I bowled over the wide open marshes, that I was burning my boats, at least in a small way. If I had left anything important behind, I could not return to fetch it for some hours. The sun was high in the sky, the water glittering. Everywhere was light, light and space and brightness. The very air seemed somehow purified and more exhilarating. Seabirds soared and swooped, silver grey and white, and ahead, at the end of the long straight path, Ealmarsh House beckoned to me. For half an hour or so after my arrival, I worked busily at establishing myself there domestically. I found crockery and cutlery in a somewhat gloomy kitchen at the back of the house, washed, dried, and laid it out for my later use, and made over a corner of the larder to my provisions. Then, after searching through drawers and cupboards upstairs, I found clean linen and blankets and set them to air before a fire I had built in the drawing room. I made other fires too, in the little parlour and in the dining room, and even succeeded, after some trial and error, in getting the great black range alight, so that by that evening I hoped to have hot water for a bath. Then I let up the blinds and opened some windows and established myself at a large desk in one of the bays of the morning room that had, I thought, the finest view of the sky, the marshes, the estuary. Beside me I set two chests of papers. Then, with a pot of tea at my right hand, and the dog Spider at my feet, I commenced my work. It was pretty tedious going, but I persevered patiently enough, untying and cursorily examining bundle after bundle of worthless old papers before tossing them into an empty box I had set beside me for the purpose. There were ancient household accounts and tradesmen's bills and receipts of 30 and 40 years or more before. There were bankers' statements and doctors' prescriptions and estimates from carpenters, glaziers and decorators. There were many letters from persons unknown and Christmas and anniversary cards, though nothing dating from recent years. There were accounts from department stores in London and scraps of shopping lists and measurements. Only the letters themselves are reserved for later perusal. Everything else was waste. From time to time, to alleviate the boredom, I looked out of the wide windows at the marshes, unshadowed still, and quietly beautiful in the winter sunlight. I made myself a lunch of ham and bread and beer, and then, a little after 2 o'clock, I called to Spider and went outside. I felt very calm and cheerful, a little cramped after my morning spent at the desk, a little bored, but in no way nervous. Indeed, all the horrors and apparitions of my first visit to the house and the marshes quite evaporated. along with the mists it had for a short time engulfed me. The air was crisp and fresh, and I walked all around the perimeter of the land upon which Healmarsh House stood, occasionally tossing a stick for the dog to chase happily after and retrieve, breathing in the clean air deeply, entirely relaxed. I even ventured so far as the ruin of the burial ground, and Spider dashed in and out, searching for real or imaginary rabbits, digging occasionally in a frantic burst with her front paws, and then bounding excitedly away. We saw no one. No shadow fell across the grass. For a while, I wandered among the old gravestones, trying to decipher some of the names, but without any success, until I reached the corner where, that last time, the woman in black had been standing. There, on the headstone, against which I was fairly certain I remembered her right, she had been leaning, I thought I could make out the name of Drablo. The letters were encrusted with a salt deposit blown, I suppose, off the estuary over years of bad winter weather. Loving memory, net Drablo, 19 and of Ilo Bor. I remembered that Mr. Jerome had hinted at some Drablo family graves, no longer used, in a place other than the churchyard, and supposed that this was the resting place of ancestors from years back. But it was quite certain that there was nothing and no one except old bones here now. And I felt quite unafraid and tranquil as I stood there, contemplating the scene and the place which had previously struck me as eerie, sinister, evil, but which now I saw was merely somewhat melancholy because it was so tumble down and unfrequented. It was the sort of spot where 100 years or more earlier, romantically minded poets would have lingered and been inspired to compose some cloyingly sad verse. I returned to the house with the dog, for already the air was turning much colder, the sky losing its light as the sun declined. Indoors, I made myself some more tea and built up the fires, and before settling down again to those dull, dull papers, browsed at random among the bookshelves in the drawing room, and chose myself some reading matter for later that evening, a novel by Sir Walter Scott and a volume of John Clare's poetry. These I took upstairs and placed on the locker of the small bedroom I had chosen to appropriate, mainly because it was at the front of the house, but not so large and cold as the others, and therefore I thought it would probably be cozier. From the window, I could see the section of marsh away from the estuary, and, if I craned my neck, the line of Nine Lives Causeway. As I worked on into the evening and it grew dark, so I lit every lamp I could find, drew curtains and fetched in more coal and wood for the fires from a bunker in the outhouse I had located outside the scullery door. The pile of waste paper grew in the box, by contrast with the few packets I thought ought to be examined more closely, and I fetched other boxes and drawerfuls from about the house. At this rate, I should be through by the end of another day and a half at the most. I had a glass of sherry and a rather limited but not unpleasant supper which I shared with Spider, and then, being tired of work, took a final turn outside before locking up. All was quiet. There was not the slightest breeze. I could scarcely hear even the creeping of the water. Every bird had long since hidden for the night. The marshes were black and silent, stretching away from me for miles. I have recounted the events, or rather the non-events, of that day at Healmarsh House in as much detail as I remember, in order to remind myself that I was in a calm and quite unexcitable state of mind, and that the odd events which had so frightened and unnerved me were all but forgotten. If I thought of them at all, it was mentally, as it were, to shrug my shoulders. Nothing else had happened. No harm had befallen me. The tenor of the day and the evening had been even, uninteresting, ordinary. Spider was an excellent companion, and I was glad of the sound of her gentle breathing, her occasional scratching or clattering about in that big, empty old house. But my main sensation was one of tedium and a certain lethargy, combined with a desire to finish the job and be back in London with my dear Stella. I remembered that I meant to tell her that we should get a small dog, as like Spider as possible, once we had a house of our own. Indeed, I decided to ask Mr. Samuel Daly that if there were ever a chance of Spider having a litter of puppies, he should reserve one for me. I had worked assiduously and with concentration and taken some fresh air and exercise. For a half an hour or so after retiring to bed, I read The Heart of Midlothian. The dog settled on a rug at the foot of my bed. I think I must have fallen asleep only a few moments after putting the lamp out, and slept quite deeply too. For when I awoke, or was awakened, very suddenly, I felt somewhat stunned, uncertain for a second or two, where I was and why. I saw that it was quite dark, but once my eyes were fully focused, I saw the moonlight coming in through the window, for I had left the rather heavy, thick-looking curtains undrawn and the window slightly ajar. The moon fell upon the embroidered counterpane and on the dark wood of wardrobe and chest and mirror with a cold, but rather beautiful light, and I thought that I would get out of bed and look at the marshes and the estuary from the window. At first, all seemed very quiet, very still, and I wondered why I had awoken. Then, with a missed heartbeat, I realized that Spider was up and standing at the door. Every hair of her body was on end, her ears were pricked, her tail erect, the whole of her tense, as if ready to spring. And she was emitting a soft, low growl from deep in her throat. I sat up, paralyzed, frozen in the bed, conscious only of the dog and of the prickling of my own skin, and what suddenly seemed a different kind of silence, ominous and dreadful. And then, from somewhere within the depths of the house, but somewhere not very far from the room in which I was, I heard a noise. It was a faint noise, and strain my ears as I might, I could not make out exactly what it was. It was a sound, like a regular yet intermittent bump or rumble. Nothing else happened. There were no footsteps, no creaking floorboards. The air was absolutely still. The wind did not moan through the casement. Only the muffled noise went on, and the dog continued to stand, bristling at the door, now putting her nose to the gap at the bottom and snuffling along, now taking a step backwards, head cocked, and like me, listening, listening. And every so often, she growled again. In the end, I suppose because nothing else had happened, because I did have the dog to take with me, I managed to get out of bed. Though I was shaken and my heart beat uncomfortably fast within me, but it took some time for me to find sufficient reserves of courage to enable me to open the bedroom door and stand out in the dark corridor. The moment I did so, Spider shot ahead, and I heard her padding about, sniffing intently at every closed door, still growling and grumbling deep in her throat. After a while, I heard the odd sound again. It seemed to be coming from along the passage to my left, at the far end. But it was still quite impossible to identify. Very cautiously, listening, hardly breathing, I ventured a few steps in that direction. Spider went ahead of me. The passage led only to three other bedroom doors on either side, and one by one, regaining my nerves, I went. I opened them and looked inside each one. Nothing. Only heavy old furniture and empty unmade beds. And in the rooms at the back of the house, moonlight. Down below me on the ground floor of the house, silence, a seething, blanketing, almost tangible silence, and the musty darkness, thick as felt. And then I reached the door at the very end of the passage. Spider was there before me, and her body, as she sniffed beneath it, went rigid. Her growling grew louder. I put my hand on her collar, stroked the rough, short hair, as much my own reassurance as for hers. I could feel the tension in her limbs and body, and it answered to my own. This was the door without the keyhole, which I had been unable to open on my first visit to Ilmarsh House. I had no idea what was beyond it, except the sound. It was coming from within that room, not very loud, but just the hand on the other side of that single wooden partition. It was a sound of something bumping gently on the floor in a rhythmic sort of way. A familiar sort of sound, and yet one I still could not exactly place. A sound that seemed to belong to my past, to waken old, half-forgotten memories and associations deep within me. A sound that in any other place would not have made me afraid, but would, I thought, have been curiously comforting, friendly. But at my feet the dog Spider began to whine, a thin, pitiful, frightened moan. And to back away from the door a little and press against my legs, my throat felt constricted and dry, and I had begun to shiver. There was something in that room, and I could not get to it, nor would I dare to if I were able. I told myself that it was a rat or trapped bird fallen down the chimney into the hearth and unable to get out again. But the sound was not that of some small panic-stricken creature. Bump, bump, pause. Bump, bump, pause. Bump, 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 bump. I think that I might have stood there in bewilderment and terror all night, or else taken to my heels with the dog and run out of the house altogether, had I not heard another faint sound. It came from behind me. Not directly behind, but from the front of the house. I turned away from the locked door and went back shakily, groping along the wall to my bedroom, guided by the slant of moonlight that reached out into the darkness of the corridor. The dog was half a pace ahead of me. There was nothing in the room at all. The bed was as I'd left it. There had been no disturbances. Then I realized that the sounds had been coming not from within the room, but outside it, beyond the window. I pulled it up as far as the sash would allow and looked out. There lay the marshes, silver-grey and empty. There was the water of the estuary, flat as a mirror with the full moon lying upturned upon it. Nothing. No one. Except, like a wash from far, far away, so that I half wondered if I were remembering and reliving the memory, a cry, a child's cry. But no, the slightest of breezes stirred the surface of the water, wrinkling it and passing dryly through the reed beds and away. Nothing more. I felt something warm against my ankle and, looking down, saw that it was Spider, very close to me and gently licking my skin. When I stroked her, I realized that she was calm again, her body relaxed, her ears down. I listened. There was no sound in the house at all. After a while, I went back along the passage to the closed door. Spider came quite happily and stood obediently there, perhaps waiting for the door to be opened. I put my head close to the wood. Nothing. Absolute silence. I put my hand on the door handle, hesitated as I felt my heart again begin to race, but drew in several deep breaths and tried the door. It would not open, though the rattling of it echoed in the room beyond, as if there were no carpet on the floor. I tried it once more and pushed against it slightly with my shoulder. It did not give. In the end, I went back to bed. I read 2 further chapters of the Scott novel, though without fully taking in their meaning, and then switched out my lamp. Spider had settled again on the rug. It was a little after 2 o'clock. It was a long time before I slept. The first thing I noticed on the following morning was a change in the weather. As soon as I awoke, a little before 7, I felt that the air had a dampness in it and that it was rather colder, and when I looked out of the window, I could hardly see the division between land and water, water and sky. All was a uniform grey, with thick cloud lying low over the marsh and a drizzle. It was not a day calculated to raise the spirits, and I felt unrefreshed and nervous after the previous night. But Spider trotted down the stairs eagerly and cheerfully enough, and I soon built up the fires again and stoked the boiler, had a bath and breakfast, and began to feel more like my everyday self. I even went back upstairs and along the corridor to the door of the locked room, but there was no strange sound from within, no sound at all. At 9 o'clock, I went out, taking the bicycle and pedalling hard to work up a good head of speed across the causeway and through the country lanes back to Crydyn, with Spider bounding behind me, and taking off every so often to burrow briefly in a ditch or start after some creature that flitted away across the fields. I had the landlord's wife refill my hamper with plenty of food and bought more from the grocer's. With both of them and with Mr. Jerome, whom I met in a side street, I spoke briefly and jestingly, and I said nothing whatsoever about the business at Ealmarsh House. Daylight, even such a dreary, damp affair as it was, had once again renewed my nerve and resolve and banished the vapours of the night. Moreover, there was a fond letter from Stella, full of gratifying exclamations of regret at my absence and pride in my new responsibility. And it was with this warming my inside pocket that I cycled back towards the marshes and the house, whistling as I went. Although it was not yet lunchtime, I was obliged to put on most of the lamps in the house, for the day lowered and the light was too poor to work by, even directly in front of the window. Looking out, I saw that the cloud and drizzle had thickened, so that I could scarcely see beyond the grass that ran down to the edges of the water, and as the afternoon began to draw in, they had merged together to form a fog. Then my nerve began to falter a little, and I decided I might pack up and return to the comfort of the town. I went to the front door and stepped out. At once the dampness clung to my face and to my clothes like a fine web. There was a stronger wind now, whipping off the estuary and going through to my bones with its raw coldness. Spider ran off a yard or two and then stopped and looked back at me. Uncertain, not anxious to walk far in such dreary weather. I could not see the ruin or the walls of the old burial ground away across the field. The low-lying cloud and mist had blotted them out. Neither could I see the causeway path, not only because of that, but because the tide had now covered it over completely. It would be late at night before it was clear again. I could not, after all, retreat to Crydyn Gifford. I whistled the dog, who came at once and gladly, and returned to Mrs. Drablow's papers. So far, I had found only one interesting-looking slim packet of documents and letters, and I decided that I would give myself the possible diversion of reading them that evening after supper. Until then, I cleared several more piles of rubbish and was cheered by the sight of the several now empty boxes and drawers, depressed by those that still remained full and unsifted. The first packet of letters, bundled together and tied with narrow purple ribbon, were all written in the same hand, between a February of about 60 years before and the summer of the following year. They were sent first from the manor house of a village I remembered from the map as being some 20 miles away from Crydyn Gifford, and later from a lodge in the Scottish countryside beyond Edinburgh. All were addressed to My Dear or Dearest Alice, and signed for the most part J, but occasionally Janet. They were short letters, written in a direct, rather naive manner, and the story they told was a touching one, and not particularly unfamiliar. The writer, a young woman, and apparently a relative of Mrs. Drablow, was unmarried and with child. At first, she was still living at home with her parents. Later, she was sent away. Scarcely any mention was made of the child's father, except for a couple of references to P. P will not come back here, and I think P was sent abroad. In Scotland, a son was born to her, and she wrote of him at once with a desperate, clinging affection. For a few months the letters ceased, but when they began again, it was at first in passionate outrage and protest, later in quiet, resigned bitterness. Pressure was being exerted upon her to give up the child for adoption. She refused, saying over and over again that they would never be parted. He's mine. Why should I not have what is mine? He shall not go to strangers. I shall kill us both before I let him go. Then the tone changed. What else can I do? I'm quite helpless. If you and Emma are to have him, I shall mind it less. And again, I suppose it must be. But at the end of the last letter of all was written in a very small, cramped hand. Love him. Take care of him as your own. But he is mine, mine. He can never be yours. Oh, forgive me. I think my heart will break. J. In the same packet, there was a simple document drawn up by a lawyer declaring that Nathaniel Pearson, infant son of Janet Humphrey, was become by adoption the child of Morgan Thomas Drablow of Ealmarsh House, Crydyn Gifford, and of his wife Alice. Attached to this were three other papers. The first was a reference from a Lady M in Hyde Park Gate for a nursemaid called Rose Judd. I had read and set this aside and was about to open the next, a single folded sheet, when I looked up suddenly, startled into the present by a noise. Spider was at the door, growling the same low growl of the previous night. I looked around at her and saw that her hackles were up. For a moment I sat, too terrified to move. Then I recalled my decision to seek out the ghosts of Ealmarsh and confront them, for I was sure, or I had been sure in the hours of daylight, that the harder I ran away from those things, the closer they would come after me and dog my heels, and the greater would be their power to disturb me. And so I laid down the papers, got to my feet, and went quietly to open the door of the small parlour in which I had been sitting. At once Spider shot out of the room, as though after a hare, and made for the staircase, still growling. I heard her scurry along the passage above and then stop. She had gone to the locked door, and even from below I could hear it again. The odd, faint, rhythmic noise. Bump, bump, pause. Bump, bump, pause. Bump, bump. Determined to break in, if I possibly could, and to identify the noise and whatever was making it, I went into the kitchen and scullery in search of a strong hammer or chisel or other forcing tool. But not finding anything there, and remembering that there was a wood axe in the outhouse where the fuel was stored, I opened the back door and, taking my torch with me, stepped outside. There was still a mist and a drizzling dampness in the air, though nothing like the dense, swirling fog of the night when I had crossed the causeway path. But it was pitch dark. There was neither moonlight nor any stars visible, and I stumbled about on my way to the shed in spite of the beam from my torch. It was when I had located the axe and was making my way back to the house that I heard the noise, and when I heard it, so close that I thought it was only a few yards from the house, turned back instead of going on, walked quickly around to the front door, expecting to greet a visitor. As I came onto the gravel, I shone my torch out into the darkness in the direction of the causeway path. It was from there that the clip-clop of the pony's hooves and the rumbling and creeping of the trap were coming. But I could see nothing. And then, with an awful cry of realization, I knew. There was no visitor. At least no real human visitor. No Keckwick. The noise was beginning to come from a different direction now, as the pony and trap left the causeway and struck off across the open marsh. I stood hideously afraid, straining into the murky, misty distance with my ears to try and detect any difference between this sound and that of a real vehicle. But there was none. If I could have run out of there, seen my way, I must surely have been able to reach it, climb up upon it, challenge its driver. As it was, I could do nothing but stand as stiff and still as a post, rigid with fear, and yet, inwardly, in a turmoil of nervous apprehension and imaginings and responses. Then I realized that the dog had come down and was beside me on the gravel, her body absolutely still, her ears pricked, facing the marsh and the source. The pony trap was going further away now. The noise of its wheels was becoming muffled, and then there was a sound of splashing water and churning mud. The noise of the pony plunging about in terror. It was happening. The whole thing was caught up in the quicksands and sinking. There was a terrible moment when the waters began to close around it and to gurgle, and then, above it all, and above the whinnying and struggling of the pony, the child's cry. That rose and rose to a scream of terror, and then was slowly choked and drowned. And finally, silence. Then nothing, save the lap and eddy of the water far away. My whole body was trembling, my mouth dry, the palms of my hands sore where I had dug my nails into them as I had stood helplessly, hearing that dreadful sequence of sounds repeated again, as it would be repeated in my head 1,000 times forever after. That the pony and trap and crying child were not real, I had no shadow of a doubt. That their final drive across the marshes and their disappearance into the treacherous quicksands had not just taken place 100 yards away from me in the darkness, of this I was now certain. But I was equally certain that once, who knew how long ago, but one actual day, this dreadful thing had indeed taken place here on Eel Marsh. A pony and trap, with whoever was its driver, together with the child passenger, had been swallowed up and drowned within a few moments. At the very thought of it, let alone at this awful, ghostly repetition of the whole event, I was more distressed than I could bear. I stood shivering, cold from the mist and the night wind and from the sweat that was rapidly cooling on my body. And then, hair bristling with eyes astart, the dog, Spider, took a couple of steps backward, half lifted her front paws off the ground and began to howl, a loud, prolonged, agonized, and heart-stopping howl. In the end, I had to lift her up and carry her inside the house. She would not move in answer to any call. Her body was stiff in my arms and she was clearly in a state of distress. And when I set her down on the floor of the hall, she clung close to my heels. In a curious way, it was her fearfulness that persuaded me that I must retain control of myself. Rather as a mother will feel obliged to put a brave face on things in order to calm a frightened child. Spider was only a dog, but nevertheless I felt obliged to soothe and reassure her, and in doing so was able to calm myself and gain some inner strength. But after a few moments of allowing herself to be stroked and petted under my hand, the dog broke away again, alert again, and growling, made for the stairs I followed her quickly, switching on every light I could find as I went. As I expected, she had made for the passage with a locked door at the end of it, and already I could hear the noise, that maddeningly familiar bump that tantalized me because I still could not identify it. I was breathing fast as I ran to the corner, and my heart seemed to be leaping about madly within me. But if I had been afraid of what had happened in this house so far, when I reached the end of the short corridor and saw what I did see now, my fear reached a new height, until for a minute I thought I would die of it. Was dying. For I could not conceive of a man's being able to endure such shocks and starts and remain alive, let alone in his right senses. The door of the room from which the noise came, the door which had been securely locked so that I had not been able to break it down, the door to which there could not be a key, that door was now standing open, wide open. Beyond it lay a room, in complete darkness, save for the first yard or two immediately at the entrance, where the dim light from the bulb on the landing outside fell onto some shining brown floor covering. Within, I could hear both the noise, louder now because the door was open, and the sound of the dog pattering anxiously about and sniffing and snuffling as she went. I do not know how long I stood there in fear and trembling and in dreadful bewilderment. I lost all sense of time and ordinary reality. Through my head went a tumbling confusion of half thoughts and emotions, visions of spectres and of real fleshy intruders, ideas of murder and violence and all manner of odd, distorted fears, and all the time the door stood wide open and the rocking continued. Rocking, yes. I came to because I had realized at last what the noise within the room was, or at least what it reminded me of closely. It was the sound of the wooden runners of my nurse's rocking chair when she had sat beside me every night when I went to sleep as a small child, rocking, rocking. Sometimes when I was ill and feverish or had wakened from the throes of some nightmare, she or my mother had come to me and lifted me out of my bed and sat with me in that same chair, holding me and rocking until I was soothed and sleepy again. The sound that I had been hearing was a sound that I remembered from far back, from a time before I could clearly remember anything else. It was the sound that meant comfort and safety, peace and reassurance, the regular rhythmical sound at the end of the day that lulled me asleep and into my dreams. The sound that meant that one of the two people in the world to whom I was closest and whom I most loved was nearby. And so, as I stood there in the dark passageway, listening, the sound began to exert the same effect upon me now, until I felt hypnotized by it into a state of drowsiness and rest. My fears and the tensions in my body they had aroused began to slip away. I was breathing slowly and more deeply, and felt a warmth creeping into my limbs. I felt that nothing could come near me to harm or affright me, but I had a protector and guardian close at hand. And indeed, perhaps I had. Perhaps all I had ever learned and believed in the nursery about unseen heavenly spirits surrounding, upholding, and preserving us was indeed true. Or perhaps it was only that my memories aroused by the rocking sound were so positive and so powerfully strong that they overcame and quite drove out all that was sinister and alarming, evil and disturbed. Whichever might be the case, I knew that I now had the courage enough to go into that room and face whatever might be there. And so, before the conviction faltered and my fears could return, I walked in as determinedly and boldly and firmly as I could. As I did so, I put my hand up to the light switch on the wall, but when I pressed it, no illumination came, and shining my torch on the ceiling, I saw that the socket was bare of any light bulb, but the beam from my own lamp was quite strong and bright. It gave me ample light for my purpose, and now, as I went into the room, Spider gave a low whine from one corner, but didn't come over to me. Very slowly and cautiously, I looked around the room. It was almost the room I had just been remembering, the room to which the sound I had identified belonged. It was a child's nursery. There was the bed in one corner, the same sort of low, narrow wooden bed that I myself had once slept in. And beside it, and facing the open fireplace at an angle, stood the rocking chair. And that too was the same or very similar, a low-seated, tall, ladder-backed chair made of dark wood, elm perhaps, and with wide, worn, curved runners. As I watched, stared, until I could stare no harder, it rocked gently and with gradually decreasing speed, in the way any such chair will continue to rock for a time after someone has just got out of it. But no one had been there. The room had been empty. Anyone who had just left it must have come out into the corridor and confronted me. I would have had to move aside to let them pass. I shone the torch rapidly all around the wall. There was the chimney breast and fireplace. There was the window, closed and bolted, and with two wooden bars across it, such as all nurseries have to guard the children from falling out. There was no other door. Gradually, the chair rocked less and less, until the movements were so slight I could scarcely see or hear them. Then they stopped, and there was absolute silence. The nursery was fully furnished and equipped in such good order that the occupant of it might only have gone away for a night or two, or even simply have taken a walk. There was none of the damp, bare, unlived-in feeling of all the other rooms of Hillmarsh House. Carefully and cautiously, almost holding my breath, I explored it. I looked at the bed, made up and all complete with sheets and pillows, blankets and counterpane. Beside it was a small table, and on the table, a tiny wooden horse and a nightlight with the candle half burned away, still in place and with water in the holder. In the chest of drawers and wardrobe, there were clothes, underclothes, day clothes, formal clothes, play clothes. Clothes for a small boy of 6 or 7 years old. Beautiful, well-made clothes, in the style of those which my own parents wore as children in those formal photographs we still have about the house, the styles of 60 years or more ago. And then there were the child's toys, so many toys, and all of them most neatly and meticulously ordered and cared for. There were rows of lead soldiers arranged in regiments, and a farm set out with painted barns and fences, haycocks and little wooden stooks of corn, and on a big board. There was a model ship, complete with masts and sails of linen, yellowed a little by age, and a whip with a leather thong lying beside a polished spinning top. There were games of Ludo and Halma, draughts and chess. There were jigsaw puzzles of country scenes and circuses, and the boyhood of Raleigh. And in a small wooden chest there was a monkey made of leather, and a cat and 4 kittens knitted from wool, a furry bear and a bald doll with a china head and a sailor suit. The child had had pens and brushes too, and bottles of coloured inks, and a book of nursery rhymes, and another of Greek stories, and a Bible and a prayer book, a set of dice and 2 packs of playing cards, a miniature trumpet, and a painted musical box from Switzerland, and a black sambo made of tin with jointed arms and legs. I picked things up, stroked them, even smelled them. They must have been here for 50 years, yet they might have been played with this afternoon and tidied away tonight. I was not afraid now. I was puzzled. I felt strange, unlike myself. I moved as if in a dream, but for the moment at least, there was nothing here to frighten or harm me. There was only emptiness, an open door, a neatly made bed, and a curious air of sadness, as something lost, missing, so that I myself felt a desolation, a grief in my own heart. How can I explain? I cannot. But I remember it, as I felt it. The dog was sitting quietly now on the rag rug beside the child's bed, and in the end, because I had examined everything and could not explain any of it, and did not want to be in that sad atmosphere any longer, I went out, after taking a last slow look around, closing the door behind me. It was not late, but I had no more energy left to go on reading Mrs. Drabblow's papers. I felt drained, exhausted, all the emotions that had poured into me and out again, leaving me like something thrown up on a calm beach at the end of a storm. I made myself a drink of hot water and brandy and did my round of the house, banking up the fires and locking the doors before going to bed to read Sir Walter Scott. Just before doing so, I went down the passageway that led to the nursery. The door was still closed as I had left it. I listened, but there was no sound at all from within. I did not disturb the silence or the emptiness again, but went quietly back to my own room at the front of the house.